And welcome to BSD Talk number 132. It's Friday, October 12, 2007. I just have an interview with Richard Stallman today, and he requested that his interview only be distributed in free audio formats. So the MP3 file is just this quick note. You'll have to download the AUG version to hear the entire interview. Anyway, here it is. Today on BSD Talk, we're speaking with Richard Stallman. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Maybe we should start with a brief introduction of yourself and what you're doing these days.
Well, I started the free software movement in 1983, and then I decided that I would develop a complete free operating system, which I called GNU. And today, most of the people that use the GNU system don't know it's the GNU system because they think it's Linux.
And could you describe the computing landscape back in the 80s? You know, what systems were available and what systems were
used? There were many different kinds of computers and many different operating systems. Microsoft was not particularly important. Microsoft made a toy system for toy computers and had absolutely nothing to do with my decision. But the most important thing about all those operating systems that existed then was that none of them respected the user's freedom. It was impossible to use a computer and have the freedom to control your own computing and to cooperate with others. And so that's what I decided to change. I wanted to be able to live in freedom. I wanted to be able to change software that I didn't like. And I wanted to be able to cooperate with other people, distribute software to other people. I didn't want to accept being forbidden to share. But how could I possibly escape from that? The only straightforward way was don't use a computer. There was no other way to escape from those restrictions in 1983. The only way there could be another way was to build a free operating system. So that's what I decided to do.
And what operating systems were you looking at when you started designing your system? Was there a particular model that you were shooting for?
Well, initially, I just wanted it to be a free system. The question of what it would be like technically, well, that was a secondary question, a merely technical question. So I thought about making it like the MIT Lisp machine system, which I had worked on and liked, but decided that that wouldn't work well on ordinary hardware. And the next idea that I thought of that might be good in a practical sense for the design was to make it like Unix, and that's what I decided to do. And then I gave it the name GNU, which means GNU's not Unix. This is a humorous way of giving credit.
And you were working towards not only a functional operating system, but also a license that matched some of your goals?
Of course, I was going to make it free software, but there are various ways to do that. Now, even at that time, there was some free software, and I had seen lax permissive licenses that basically say, you can do whatever you like with this program. And I had also seen that that sometimes led to modified or extended versions which were not free software. So I thought about that and realized that that would be self-defeating. If my goal was to give users freedom, to release software under a lax permissive license wouldn't lead to that result because somebody else would make improvements in it and would release a non-free modified version. And so the users would get that and they wouldn't have the freedom. Or I might try to duplicate myself the improvements that were made in that non-free modified version. But then the person who made that version would always have the advantage because any changes I made and put into the free version, he could just use. But his changes would not be free, so I couldn't use them. So I thought that, I recognized that if I used that kind of license, I would be creating a situation where I would be always at a disadvantage and freedom would be at a disadvantage. So I thought about how to stop that. And the method I came up with is the method we call copyleft. And that's implemented in the GNU General Public License, or GNU GPL. The idea of copyleft is that the license itself insists that every version made from that code has to be free software in the same way.
And I guess at that time, protecting people's freedoms in relation to computers may not have had as broad of an impact because not many people at that time were directly using computers.
That's right. It was a sort of niche within society. But since I was in that niche and I wanted to live in freedom, free software was absolutely essential for me. I either had to develop a free operating system or stop using computers. And I, you know, one is to liberate your homeland, the other is to flee into exile. It's much better to liberate your homeland. And computing was my homeland, you might say. So even though not everybody lived there, I still wanted it to be free. Today, almost everybody in wealthy countries does live there. And so it's vital for society for that land to be free, to liberate cyberspace.
Especially for me, I'm watching more and more of my ability to be a citizen in the United States involving computers. Just voting, registering my car online, paying taxes, interacting with my town now quite often requires using a computer. And if I choose not to use a computer, I end up having to go to the town office during its limited hours or other kinds of things. So just even as a citizen, I'm disadvantaged if I choose to run away from computers.
And in many parts of the world, the government uses servers that run Windows, and you can only talk to them if you're using Windows. So these governments have essentially been corrupted into pushing the citizens to use non-freedom respecting software.
I guess that's a hard process right now, is trying to help people understand why free software is important in their daily lives. I think a lot of people just think that they want to buy a computer and it can let them check their email, and it's not a concern.
Right. A lot of people think of a computer as just a tool, and they don't ask themselves, who decides what they can do with the tool and what they can't do with the tool? They don't ask, who controls your computer? But once you start to ask that, you see that free software is essential for a free society, because computers are used for essential activities in society. And if the computer is not running free software, then you can't control you don't control those activities. The software's developer controls them.
I guess those are two categories of people who think about software, both the end user and the developer. And perhaps it's easier to get developers to think about licenses because they license
them. Well, yes, because if you know how to program and you envision making changes in programs, then you'll see immediately what it means not to have the source code, or to be told you're not allowed to change it, or to discover that if you change it, it won't run anymore, or to be told, yes, you can change it, but you can't distribute what you changed to somebody else, and he can't distribute what he changed to you, so you're on your own completely in making any changes. So what you discover is that in those situations, the developer has effectively total power over what the users do. Whereas with free software, the users decide what the software does. And even the users that don't write programs themselves, that don't know how to program themselves, can participate in the social decision, the democratic decision about what the program will do in the future.
And when you meet developers, as I'm sure you spend a lot of time doing, how do you approach the discussion? You know, how do you get them to see some benefit to releasing their code under a free license?
Well, actually, I don't try to do that very much. I don't bring this issue up from the viewpoint of why you, developing a program, would find it advantageous to respect other people's freedom. Because the point is, it's your moral duty. You've got no right to trample other people's freedom. Non-free software is a social problem. it's wrong. And that's what I argue. I argue that position with programmers or non-programmers, whoever it happens to be, because it's the same issue. And so what I tell people is not whatever your aims are, you'll achieve them more if you respect other people's freedom. Because that's not always true. There are aims for which subjugating other people is advantageous, but it isn't right.
I see. So there's a variety of licenses that achieve your goals or at least respect other people's freedoms.
Right. There are many licenses that respect other people's freedoms. There are four essential freedoms that the user should have. And there are lots of ways to write a license that respects those four freedoms. So there are lots of free software licenses. However, the main distinction between them is that some are copyleft licenses and some are not. The copyleft licenses say that anybody distributing the software in any version must respect the freedom of those that he distributes to. And then there are the non-copyleft licenses which, that don't make that requirement. So, for instance, both of the BSD licenses are non-copyleft licenses.
So for the people out there who are trying to write free software, what are the common threats, I guess you could say? Because, you know, I know, at least here in the United States, there are a variety of ways for people who are not participating in the writing of the software to really sabotage that software's usefulness through things like patents.
There are several threats. And I should point out that the most basic threat is when some essential file format or protocol is secret so that we can't even find out what job needs to be done. Now, this form of obstruction isn't done using laws. It's done just by keeping secrets. But it's extremely harmful to free software. However, if we look beyond that, then we get to the problems of using legal obstruction to stop people from developing free software to do the job. Now, patents are one of those. The U.S. has a foolish policy of allowing software techniques and features to be patented. And when such a thing is patented, that means anybody that implements it can get sued. And since a large program typically combines thousands of ideas, it's likely to be prohibited by hundreds of different patents at the same time. There's also, in some cases, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which was the way that the U.S. government took the side of the people who make digital handcuffs against the people whose wrists they are on, namely the citizens. So the Digital Millennium Copyright Act says that when works are published with DRM, Digital Restrictions Management, then anything, distributing anything that enables the users to escape from the restrictions is illegal. Thus, for instance, distributing the free software that can read an encrypted DVD is illegal in the U.S. That software has been censored.
To me, that's really interesting how the precedent that we have in the U.S. for fair use of copyrighted or copywritten material can be superseded by even very simple copy protection.
Fair use is something that's in the law, but this is a different law. And they were cunningly evil about it. They didn't take away fair use as such. They say that it's legal to access the DRM-afflicted work if it's fair use. However, in practice, it'll be impossible because distributing the program or machine that might enable you to actually do that is illegal. So unless you figure it out for yourself and build it yourself, there's no way you'll be able to exercise the rights to fair use that theoretically you still have. It's like saying driving is legal, but selling cars is not.
And in both of these cases, we're talking about U.S. law.
Well, sad to say, when something is wrong in the U.S., the U.S. government, instead of trying to correct it, tries to extend the problem to the rest of the world. And the U.S. has been very effective at extending this particular problem to other countries, usually through sweatshop treaties, in addition to making sure that people have bad working conditions all around the world. These treaties also frequently require all the countries involved to have laws similar to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Because the U.S. government works for the mega corporations. It's their servant or their pet.
So if people want to make a difference, I'm sure there's a variety of ways, but what are the ways that you've chosen to try and effect some change?
I try to inform people in other countries of the danger of these laws so that they can resist them.
And I guess another broader topic that I wanted to talk about was this whole variety of licenses we have. And I think that some people have created some licenses that may appear to be close to free licenses. And I wouldn't necessarily want to say that their intent is to confuse the issue. But I think there might be...
I don't know. I mean, that's so vague. I don't know what licenses you mean.
They provide source code, and they try and equate things like open with free.
Well, that's a different thing. You know, what a license requires is one thing, and choice of terminology and concepts is a different thing. And I think it's best to keep those two questions separate. And there are people who talk about the GNU General Public License and describe it as an open source license. Well, version 2 of the GNU GPL was accepted by the OSI, so officially it counts as an open source license. I didn't design it with the goal of making it one, but it is one. But that's one thing, and whether you hold the values and concepts of open source or the values and concepts of free software is a different question. Whichever your values are, the GPL still is what it is. So you could call it an open source license, you could call it a free software license. It is both of them. But the question of what the GPL is and what it does is one question, and the question of whether we care about freedom as a value is a different question. People who hold open source views do use the GNU GPL.
If you happen to use a computer operating system, let's say a distribution like Ubuntu or an operating...
That's one of the distributions of the GNU plus Linux system, I should point out.
Yes. Or something like FreeBSD, it's difficult to find something distributed on a CD that you can install on your computer that contains only a single license. Quite often, it's
right,
made up of a bunch of different licenses.
Because an operating system is a lot of programs together, and they don't all have to have the same license, and in fact, they don't have the same license.
Sometimes the choice of different pieces of software that get added into an operating system, there can be some confusion or some arguments about how compatible
they
are.
Yes, that's an awfully general thing to say. To make it useful, I think you should call a spade or a club, or a heart. I mean, then I'll know which one it is.
Yeah. Well, I guess I could say, do you feel that there's some risks in incorporating code that's under licenses that are more restrictive?
Well, I guess I'm confused. Which licenses do you mean?
A common example would be ZFS from Sun Microsystems, which is under the CUDL, CDDL license.
I don't remember what that license is. In fact, I don't even remember if it's a free software license. I'd have to go check the list because I don't remember what's in that license. But basically, when you're mixing together code with different licenses in a way that makes them part of one program, then you have the issue of license compatibility. Because in order for it to be legal to combine these pieces, the combination has to satisfy all of the different licenses of the pieces.
You know, let's say there's a piece of software that's licensed under a license that perhaps isn't respecting freedom as much as it should.
Oh, wait, sorry. That's too vague. Do you mean a non-free license?
Sure, yes.
Well, if it's a non-free license, then you shouldn't use that code at all, period, because it's not ethical. Aside from that, it will certainly be incompatible with the GNU GPL. But that's merely a legal question, whereas the unethical nature of a non-free program is something more important. It's an ethical question.
Yeah, and I think, though, that there are distributions that have the opinion that instead of not using the non-free software, that they would rather include it and then build a relationship and a customer base, which will allow them...
Well, yes, there are unethical distributions of GNU/Linux. There are lots of them. In fact, most of them do include non-free software, which means that if you're installing one of those, you might get a system that isn't entirely freedom-respecting. So the only thing we ought to do with those distributions is not recommend them. I can't recommend to people that they install a collection of software that isn't entirely free, because what would happen if I did? The person might go and get that distribution and see some non-free software and think it looks nice and install it. And then he would be using a non-free program because I led him to. Well, I don't want that to happen. So I just don't recommend any collection of software that has something non-free in it. So this is the ethical standard I believe in and that I follow. So as I see it, there's no point even discussing the questions of how to use non-free software, because you shouldn't. And you shouldn't distribute it, and you shouldn't recommend it to other people. I'm unhappy with the various distributions of BSD, because all of them include in their installation systems, in some cases I believe it's called a port system, I don't know if they all use that term, they all include some non-free programs. And as a result, I can't recommend any of them. Now, I'm sad about that. I wouldn't reject BSD just because it isn't GNU. It's a different operating system, but fundamentally it's a free operating system, so fundamentally I ought to be able to recommend it. But there is no distribution that is entirely free, and that I think is a sad thing. I wish there were one that I could recommend.
What do you say to the people that feel that the way towards freedom is to try and get a customer base? Let's take the NVIDIA drivers.
I think it's a mistake. I think it's focusing on the short term at the expense of the long term. You see, I've been in our community ever since I started building it, and I see what our weaknesses are. Our main weakness is a tendency to forget about freedom, to get so lost in issues of practical convenience that we forget about the idea of trying to head for freedom. And that is disastrous. There's nothing more disastrous than forgetting the place that you are going to go to. So, as I see it, getting more users by not telling them about the goal of freedom predictably leads to a community in which most people have never heard of the goal of freedom. And then, why would they ever head for that goal? They won't. So what I've seen already tells me that it's a mistake, because this, in fact, is what has happened with the GNU plus Linux system. Lots of people tried to promote it, to get users. They thought that the goal was to have more users, and some of them tried to justify this, saying, well, let's get more users and then it will be easier for us to make a better system, and then we'll get everybody to use it. Well, in one sense, it does help. The problem is that when you get these more users by not telling them about freedom, then they might think the way to make a better system is by adding some non-free program to it. And that has, in fact, happened over and over. So what I conclude is that it's a mistake to think that we're going to get to freedom by failing to teach people to think about freedom. The way you teach people to insist on freedom is by setting an example and telling them what you're doing. So you have to explain the idea of freedom, and then you have to show you care. And the way you show you care about freedom is by showing that you will pass up a convenient opportunity that is convenient in a practical sense but involves giving up your freedom. That's the way you show that freedom matters to you, by saying, even though it's inconvenient to do it this way, I will do it this way because this is the way that I can keep my freedom and I want my freedom. If you talk about freedom, but then you give it up in exchange for some convenience, what you show people is you don't really value it that much. And if you don't talk about freedom at all, then most people will never even think about the question. They'll only think about the question if they come up with it on their own.
And I guess by giving up that convenience, let's take Flash, for example, that inconvenience definitely motivates you to write a free alternative.
Exactly. If you think that a non-free program is a solution, you're likely to just accept it. But if you recognize that a non-free program is a problem, then you might try to solve the problem. And the solution is replace it with free software.
So how is the community doing? Are we making headway?
Well, yes. Compared with where we were, say, 10 years ago, we're doing a lot better now. We have free software to do a lot more. Free operating systems are a lot easier to use, especially for non-wizards. And the community is bigger, and there are more people who have heard these ideas of freedom. And we can see that the community is stronger, but we haven't won the war.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Happy hacking.
All right. Thank you very much.
Bye.
If you'd like to leave comments on the website or reach the show archives, you can find them at bsdtalk.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to send me an email, you can reach me at bitgeist@yahoo.com. That's bitgeist@yahoo.com. Thank you for listening. This has been BSD Talk number 132.